Good afternoon. Tuesday, 5 o'clock in the UK. I am back home in London after 2.5 weeks in the Cayman Islands. And last week I had my first ever one of these weekly conversations where I was in the same room as my guest, Morgan DaCosta, which was literally a unique experience because this is very much a product of the pandemic, having weekly conversations that people can tune into live or later by video or podcast. So welcome to What Comes Next Live. And my guest this week is my good friend, Peter Lederer, coming live and direct from his house in Edinburgh. And Peter and I are both very much from the hotel industry. His career significantly more illustrious, not just than mine, but than pretty much all but a very few hoteliers in the world ever. There you go. That's bigging you up, Peter. Peter took a, I'll let him talk a bit more about it, but, without Peter, Gleneagles would not be what it is today, which is one of the top 10 hotels in the world. And yet he's left there quite a number of years ago and has many strings to his bow. He has been a great mentor to me and I hope to have contributed to his own lifelong learning. We talk often. I always get a lot from it. So I'm so glad to get to have you on so that others can join our conversation and tune into it. Welcome, Peter. How are you?
Thank you, Tom. Yes, very well. Greetings from Edinburgh.
Yep. And so, yep. So if we just start out, tell us a little bit about yourself and then we'll get into the conversation.
Sure. Yeah. So I born and raised in London, went to hotel school in London after a failed, school career, years later discovering I was dyslexic, but, didn't know about those things in those days. So I had quite a tough and pretty miserable school life and came out with not a lot of qualifications, found something I could do in the hotel. There's a course called Hotel Management and Catering in those days, which attracted me because it was a 4-year course, but it was what they called a sandwich course. So you had 5 months of experience and then 5 months in college. So that suited me. But at the end of that, 1972, UK was a pretty miserable place. It was bankrupt. It was rubbish piled 6 feet on every street corner. Everybody was on strike. It was a pretty seriously tough place to be. And as a 21-year-old, I thought, this hasn't got a lot of future. And I applied to go to the United States and I applied to go to Canada. United States came back to me saying, yes, that's fine, but you do realize you're eligible for call up to Vietnam. I thought, let me think about that for a nanosecond or two. Ended up going to Canada, where I had 12, as it turned out, amazing years. I'd gone then, vowed never to come back to the UK and stay international, but had 12 very happy years in Canada with four seasons. I was involved in an entrepreneurial venture building discotheques. I've probably built more discotheques and been involved in more discotheques than most people on the planet. But that was a fun time. But Kate went back to hotels and then was asked to come back to kind of a recently privatized product, a business called Gleneagles. Gleneagles, along with two hotels in Edinburgh, the North British and the Caledonian, had been sold by, in fact, they were the first deal Mrs. Thatcher concluded when she came to power in 79. The first deal she made was to sell those three hotels, 600 acres in Perthshire and two prime sites on each end of Princes Street in Edinburgh for the princely sum of £9 million. Deals you wish you'd done. quite masochistic in my career and tend to go for things that look pretty difficult and people advise me not to do. And Gleneagles, those days was closed 5 months a year. It closed in October, reopened at Easter every year. And the project was, can we build the winter business? Can we open this hotel year round and build a 12-month business? And that was a challenge that I found difficult to resist. And in fact, I didn't. And I started work on it. Immediately in the following 20 months, we had three different owners because of various takeovers. And I ended up as part of Guinness in 86. which was fascinating because this is the time of those who remember of Ernest Saunders and all the fuss about Guinness. But they were amazing. Learned a huge amount about corporate life and what happens and what you should and shouldn't do, and also about ethics and values. And that was very interesting, seeing when you're on the wrong side of that slightly. It makes you focus on your own. And I was involved with Gleneagles for 25 years running it. I said to Diageo, the owners at that time, which was the merger of Grand Metropolitan and Guinness, as people don't know, that I thought 25 years was enough, building the business and doing all the fun things we've been doing. Diageo had been very good to me in letting me do non-exec things for quite a long time. And one of the main things I did then was chair Visit Scotland, which is the tourism body for Scotland, and also sat on the Visit Britain board for tourism. I did that for 9 years from 2001, took it over at a time when another masochistic tendency, part of my masochistic tendencies, took over an organization just a year after mad cow disease, foot and mouth, and 9/11. Mm-hmm. And from the tourism, those of you in the tourism industry in 2001, it really was, it looked like a lot of industries, well, it's the world has come to a halt for a couple of days. Anyway, I did that for 9 years. But after 25 years at Gleneagles in about 2007, 2008, I had a very good successor. One of my highlights of my career was getting the Ryder Cup to Scotland and to Gleneagles, which was the first meeting I ever had with Jack Nicklaus at the Muirfield Club in the States in Ohio to talk about. It was in 1989 and it was played in 2014. We got it in 2001. So talk about long-term project management, long-term thinking, but it had to be. But I didn't, getting the event was the key thing for me. Running the event, it was just another event to me, but I'd had a successor who was very keen to run it, and he was a very good successor, and he was ready and very able. And I wanted him to have a shot at the position. So I said to Diageo, I would, this time was probably up. And they said no. So I worked with Diageo for the next until the end of 2014 as the director in Scotland, really around corporate affairs, public affairs for the business, as well as chairing Gleneagles for that time until, say, the end of 2014. And since then, it's been continuing the non-exec. I chair the Royal Edinburgh Military Tattoo, which is a charity. I chair a business called Hamilton & Inches, which is a silver jewelry and watch business in Edinburgh. I'm on the board of Baxter's Food Group, which is now a £500 million business global in the food manufacturing business. I'm on the board of a company called Hotel Management Company. And I'm just getting involved in a whole area, a new area of vertical farming, which is really fascinating. We might talk a little bit about. So that's me now, trying to keep it in balance with, not trying to work too hard, but keep my brain working.
Yeah. If people listen, think, what did they hear? 25 years. When you started at the beginning of 25 plus years, a bankrupt railway hotel, from a company that didn't have a clue how to run it, which was a nationalized railway. Which then not only ran the Ryder Cup, but also ran the G8 Summit. Very close to that, right? And
2005.
Ultimately one of the top hotels in the world. And, I have to say, the only time I've ever played decent golf around Gleneagles was on the Ryder Cup, of course. but we met in around 2005-ish, that kind of time. And that was linked to another thing you did. And I was a much smaller level. Well, there's some parallels there because I was involved in tourism in the Cayman Islands and right. From about 2000 onwards and a hotelier there. And we had different reasons for tourism to collapse. And Saturday, I was flying from Miami to the UK. It was an amazing day to travel for two main reasons. One, because Emma Raducanu won the US Open, and I was watching it in a bar in Miami Airport waiting for my flight. But actually, the bigger reason is the 20th anniversary of 9/11.
Of course. Yeah.
And in the aftermath for that, Americans didn't want to travel. So massive amount. And I was heading up wasn't the chairman of it. Wasn't the same structure, but I was heading up for the hotel sector, our involvement with Visit Scotland's equivalent in the Cayman Islands.
Yep.
So lots of parallels. And then where we really connected was around something called the Saltire Foundation.
That's right.
And in fact, that's about really creating the leaders of tomorrow. And you were chairing that, I believe, as well.
Yeah, that's right. I was the second chair of it. And you're right. And extremely proud of that, because some of the young people you and I both know have come out of that, both as fellows and scholars. It's amazing to see their career paths and wonderful to see, especially, as I say, if you've had education, I touched on it earlier, because of my education was actually quite difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Education, training, development has always been really important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing young people leave Scotland to go and work somewhere for 8 weeks, as the Saltire did, and see them come back 8 weeks later, different people,
mm-hmm.
different objectives, different vision, different thoughts on their career, was just amazing to see. You know, very proud of all of them. They're an amazing group.
And a couple of thoughts around that is, one is that's now been running around 15, 16 years. And the beta test was my first guest on this show and somebody you introduced me to many, many years ago, which is Mark Beaumont, who then went on to be a global adventurer.
He saw
the possibilities of, I don't need to follow a conventional career path. And he's certainly carved his own path. There must be something like 1,500 alumni of these programs now.
Yeah.
And it's more than 200 every year. And, you know, going back in our history is I took somebody from the first full year of that program called Sarah Jane Whitehill. And she went on to win not just Employee of the Year in Tourism in Cayman, then Manager of the Year in Tourism in Cayman a few years later. And she now fell in love with a bartender at the resort who was American. And so she's been living up in the States for years. Continues to work for the Cayman business doing marketing that she worked for back then. So there's a career path. And the other parallel was that in talking with you, I asked, we had a rising star in our business called Brian Ebanks, who was in his early 20s. And if I remember correctly, you took him across for an internship program you had at Gleneagles. So it wasn't just 8 weeks, it was about 3 months.
Yeah.
We, unfortunately, there's the adage of if the CFO is being tight for funds on developing and training people, they'll turn around to whoever wants to invest in people and says, what if we train them and they leave? And the answer is, what if we don't and they stay?
That's
well, right. We gave Brian this great opportunity, a young Caymanian, and he left. And he also married somebody he met at the resort. And I just saw his Instagram the other day, and he now has 3 kids.
Yeah.
And it continues to thrive, and I stay in touch with him. So
that's good.
Education is, and it's amazing to see the leaders that some of these young people have become. So
yeah,
it's fantastic stuff.
No, it's very exciting.
So so that's where you are now, and these are, you know, the tattoo is one that we've talked about a little bit. I'm sure many people know it, but it's the flagship event of the Edinburgh Festival, held on the Esplanade of Edinburgh Castle with pipe bands and all kinds of stuff. It's always sold out years in advance. And of course, as the chair of that, you've had to deal with it not running for the last 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are you seeing into, you know, for me, leadership's about people and behavior. And I'm sure we could talk for hours about stories around how you brought that to bear in Gleneagles. But what are you observing in, you know, in a sort of, you're not retired, but you're easing back to just a few days a week to get your brain going. But what are you seeing? What are you observing is happening now? What challenges and opportunities do you see? And the masochistic bit I identify with, by the way, I was told that you'll never get Caymanian management. You'll have to have expats all the time. You'll never get majority Caymanian staff. And I just got really difficult about it. I went, watch me. It's like, so I'm with that. But, you know, what if I made you prime minister, I mean, this is not a political thing, but if I put you in charge, whether of Scotland or the UK, what would you be seeing are the issues that need addressed? And then perhaps what might you do?
Yeah. Well, I think leadership, one of the things about leadership is, to me, and often a missing, and no surprise when people don't follow, is leaders tend not to be able to articulate a vision, you know, of where we're going. So for something, you know, whether it's a tattoo or Gleneagles or any business, that, you know, people seem to think that you can just tell people that, you know, oh, we're just going in this direction, but without articulating what success looks like and what the destination looks like. Mm-hmm. And I always argue that, you know, it's like going to a train station and telling people to get on a train where they don't know the destination or the price of the ticket or when it's going to get there. They just wouldn't get on the train. So why do we expect people in organizations to, or countries, without that vision, without that ability or that articulation of what success might look like? It won't look the same, but what it might look like if we do the following things. And I do think there's a lot of that missing, and whether that's in all levels of government. And it's very easy just to blame government. Having done a government job, and you've been involved with government roles as well, you know, it's very easy to blame government, but actually people need to contribute as well. It's not about leaving it to politicians and civil servants. But what worries me at the moment, as if I was prime minister in that situation, is the disconnect between business and government at all levels. You know, there's a, you know, whether it's in this city, for example, whether it's in Scotland generally, whether it's in the UK, it seems to me, and I'm not sure what it's like elsewhere in the world, but certainly the UK at the moment seems to be a disconnect between that business and even we heard yesterday CBI and unions talking about, you know, well, why aren't we talking to each other? And that vision piece post the pandemic, can we shape a different future? You know, during the pandemic, lots of people said, oh, well, you know, this allows us to do things differently. But, well, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And who's going to articulate what that might mean, whether it's in a business, whether it's in a city, or whether it's in a country? So I think there's and within that, we've also got to understand, I think, post-pandemic, what's happened to people's individual thinking. Mm-hmm. Because it's almost possible to give people a year, basically a lot of them sitting at home, not engaged in a work situation, and for them not to think about what they want to do and what they don't want to do. And you were seeing some of that now. Now, at one extreme, there's a whole issue around mental health, and that's been very difficult. Yeah. The other end of that spectrum, also, there are people that you and I know who are really quick on seizing opportunities and seeing that's going running with them. Mm-hmm. But the majority are in the middle, who kind of have done quite a lot of thinking about what they want to do and what they don't want to do. But it's been interesting how that plays out. So if people say, well, I don't want to go back to the office, I want to work 5 days a week from home, or increasingly 4 days a week from home, what does that mean and how does that work? And is it feasible? Is it sustainable? And it might be good for some people, but it's definitely not for other people. You know, the thought of staying home for another year for some people will tip them over the edge.
Yeah.
And other people do. So a lot of these issues, and then you feed in technology, you feed in new models that are coming out of it, whether it's in my old hotel space, you know, that's the lack of people, you know, lack of people in to recruit is going to drive very different models and very different behaviors and rapid uptake of technology. And the same with things, you know, that vertical farming business I talked about. You know, if you think about the possibilities that could deliver, mm-hmm. new ideas like that, you start to see if there are huge opportunities for those governments we were talking about and those and for business, but they need to be talking to each other and they need to be shaping things together, as many organizations together. So that collaboration piece, I think is a real, is going to be a, and it's difficult when you've, when everybody's been at home kind of separated to bring people back together again is a real, is, I think it's going to be a struggle for a while.
Yeah, I'm running an offsite next week in person for the partners in a client of mine that's a boutique city professional services firm. And it'll be the first time the partners have actually all been in the same room in 18 months.
That's so, right. Well,
and they said, what are we going to talk about? I said, as a facilitator, the first 2 or 3 hours, we're just going to talk. It's like, how are you? How's the family? It's like, and in the room. I totally agree with you about the articulating a vision. And in fact, I have a one line job description for a CEO, which is to be keeper of the vision. And I always say to CEOs I work with, the less you do, the more valuable you are.
Yep.
So, much like a GM walking around a hotel, don't want to be picking up things and telling people too much. Once you're at a certain level, the new GM will do that all the time. But after a while, you just have some more subtle ways of doing it. Yeah. Much like I'm an international swimming referee. I don't actually look at the pool at all during the races. I look at the people who are delegated to do the work. But that's really important. And I'll come to that because a few thoughts that you've spurred in me. It's absolutely key thing to observe is a disconnect between business, unions, government, etc. One of those disconnects to me though is that the short-term nature of many businesses and the short-term focus with publicly traded companies with quarterly reporting and earnings calls and having to hit budgets. And this has created opportunities for radical change, not just incremental change. And some of that is around the world of work. And what does it mean to have an office, etc. So the opportunities, at the same time, there is so much uncertainty. Again, when we talk about the return to work idea, I'm talking to business leaders around the world and they say, so what are you picking up? What simple advice would you give? And I say the simple advice is be comfortable with ambiguity for several years. Yeah. The problem for those people that you refer to in the middle ground, the bulk of people, and for those who are feeling more anxious and more fragile with mental health is that we kind of need stability as humans. We need to know not just where are we going and which direction is that train taking us to, but do we have a seat on the train and how fast is it traveling and what's the general route? We need that stability and we can't give it as leaders. We can't give it to people. So, an example for me, I just had 30 plus one-to-one meetings in Cayman in 8 working days, which sounds like a lot, but there's no travel distance there. So it's great. Coffees and breakfast and lunches. Loved it. Very, very good for me to personally do that. One of the things I noticed though is that there is this desire to just protect what they have. It's a very wealthy country. Mm-hmm. So there is a real inertia. You don't have people who are, in your words, masochistic, in my words, just like, right, I'll prove you wrong. That kind of energy to go to put a, what do they call it in modern language? A BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal to put something really big out there. And the most famous one we all learn in management leadership school is JFK saying we're going to put a man on the moon by the end of the '60s. At the which point NASA was 3 men and a dog in Houston, right? And that somehow they made it happen. So my idea for the Cayman Islands is remains, and I don't mind being, I've been talking to everybody about it, is go borrow a ton of money on the capital markets that you can pay back in 50 years. And by the way, I checked, they can do it. They have a great credit rating. And invest it in becoming the green industry capital of the Caribbean. By the way, vertical farming is just starting there too. But at the moment, there are major obstacles to that. You need to retrain a huge amount of the workforce. And you also have a monopoly power company that would need to be on side with this. But it does take that visionary leadership. Yep. And where you've got politicians who are just thinking about the next 24-hour poll. By the way, during the last election, both parties were running almost live focus groups and polling. So they're changing their messages twice a day based upon massive amounts of polling. What's the exact wording we need to have on the 6 o'clock news and on the 8 a.m. news? But what's the big picture? There is a big opportunity to, you know, and COP26 is coming up in Glasgow. There's a big opportunity to change the world, but we have to look at different timeframes, and the politicians have to look at much longer timeframes in order to give people solidity. They say in the next 10 years, Scotland or Britain or Cayman are going to focus on these areas. They also then need to do is to create alignment with business to go, you need to optimize your return on capital, not maximize it. Because by maximizing it for the last 50 years, we've burned the planet. Can you make a 4% return on capital for the next 50 years? How would that be? You're not losing money, you know? So I'm just, you've got me thinking about different areas, because we honestly can't give people security and stability on the world of work. It's going to keep changing. And I said to my guest a couple of weeks ago, the people who can immediately work from home and go, I don't need to be in the office. If they can think 5 years ahead, their job's going to move to another country.
Yeah.
So it's not a matter of moving out of London or moving out of Edinburgh. It's a matter of, if it's that easy for you to work from home remotely permanently, if you're in the UK or any other high cost jurisdiction, you're probably not going to have a job in 5 to 10 years. If your job depends upon you having personal relationships and random encounters with people in the office where you can come bring up new ideas, like how penicillin was invented by randomness, then you've got wisdom workers as opposed to knowledge workers.
No, it's a very good point. Very good. It's fascinating, because there's the employees at the moment feel quite emboldened. They feel quite that they can call the shots now, but as you say, it's not quite as simple as they think. I think the people who already moved from cities to move out to the Cotswolds or wherever, thinking, I'll just do 5 days a week from home, you're absolutely right, you haven't necessarily thought things through.
And so the dynamics between the companies and the employees are, if we're committed to bricks and mortar businesses like the hotel business, if we're committed to making that work for the long term, and it may take a few years for it to settle down, and if you built your career in the hotel industry, then it's not the perfect example because it's pretty mobile. But if you want to stay in your own country, you've got to think about what's the compact between employer and employee. Just as we did, which is a language that the unions used to use. And what's the compact between business and government? Because ultimately governments are representatives of the people who vote for them. A lot of the word disconnect is what strikes me, is that if you're observing a disconnect, then that's the bridge to create. And I would just throw it right back and go, I would quite imagine when you took over Gleneagles, you had, what you said, 3 different owners in the first 2 years.
Yep.
And you know, people look up the history of Ernest Saunders and Guinness. It was, let's just say, toxic time for corporate Britain. And every single one of the people you'd be talking to would have a different view as to what they wanted from Gleneagles, how fast, in what direction. And meanwhile, I'd imagine you would have had a vision, but you might not have fully formed all of the steps in it the first year or two.
Certainly the first year or two, you're almost fighting that it'll never work. You spend quite a lot of energy just proving that keep going, because it can work. Because, you know, even 3 or 4 years in, people were saying, oh, you'll end up closing again in the winter. It did work, and we worked very hard at it in all sorts of ways. But it all worked. But you had to, and again, it's this long term. You know, there are a lot of people you and I know who've had careers that move every 2 years and never take responsibility for their decisions.
Hmm.
The interesting thing about if you do something long term, I mean, I had lots of different opportunities within that, which was great. And so that it was unusual, and you probably never to be repeated. But I lived with every single decision I made.
Yes. Because,
you know, whether it 5 years later, 10 years later, I lived with the consequences of a decision that I took, which is very different to people who are, and it's another facet of that, not just politicians thinking short term, it's people thinking about their bonus and moving on. So you're making decisions around your, potentially around your remuneration, as opposed to what may be best for the business.
There are so many parallels. I worked for a family holding company for 16 years, and then when I resigned, they wouldn't let me go for several years. So the phrase that strikes me is ownership.
Yeah.
Really taking ownership of our decisions. And what occurs to me is a past client of mine who was responsible for closing down the decision to close down a large operation on one continent. And then the company moved him to head up another operation, another continent. And he says, you need to let go of that and move to this one. And he said, look, we haven't sold off that part of the business. They didn't close it down. They made a decision to let go of it and sell it off. And there are many hundreds of families that will not feel secure until we've completed the deal. So I'm going to fly back and forward between these continents twice a month and do both jobs until it's done.
Yeah.
Now that person came from one of the oldest businesses in the UK, and where they spent 20 years of their career. So by the time they moved to this shorter term type business, they just said, my language around that is they took ownership.
Yeah.
No, I think. And, when they went back to a number of years later, went back to the place where they closed it down, having sold it off, having looked after the people. One of their staff said, hey, I hear you're coming to town. Can we meet for drinks after work? And thinking they're meeting one person, they showed up and 60 past staff showed up. This was a person who fired them all.
you can
look after your people. You can fire people in a good way.
Absolutely. Always don't take away their pride and their self-respect. That's, and their self-esteem. That's right. Quite right. It's fascinating. I mean, the changes at the moment, it's just in this city, you know, which seems to be back to normal. If you look at the traffic, it's absolutely back to normal. And yet offices are getting back to normal. You are seeing more, but it's certainly not back to pre-COVID levels. But it's been fascinating just to see how that's going to pan out and who is going to have to come back to the office and who isn't.
The most important question, though, is your favorite restaurant open for you to have your espressos in the mornings?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yes, it is. So they take very good care of me, yes.
By the way, if anybody walks into that restaurant, which will remain nameless for the moment, but most people in Edinburgh know it's where people have business coffees. When you walk in, the booth on the far right as you walk in, don't sit in it first thing in the morning. That's Peter's chair.
Sustained by espresso, yeah.
That's a sign of a long-time hotelier, I think. We've just ran through half an hour very quickly, and the kind of key points are actually evergreen, which is around the importance of articulating a vision, which I think we both agreed tends to be in short supply right now, and for understandable reasons, that you're dealing in a crisis moment by moment. And where we are now, whether it's Cayman, England, Scotland, each with different governments with that responsibility, is looking at what's next. Even if what's next is more uncertainty. The people are fatigued, and Professor Adam Grant uses a phrase languishing, which is very different from being exhausted. It's just a long-term thing. People need something to look ahead to.
Yeah.
And the idea of this, which is important for the individuals with all the uncertainty, and then this level of where you see disconnects, and if it's important, because a really experienced business leader like yourself, where if you see, you know, if you're a chair, basically your job in any body or organization or business as a chair is to align people around that vision. So it's of concern to note that somebody of your stature is seeing those disconnects. And sometimes the quest questions are more important than answers right now, and all we're doing is raising the question.
Well, I think, as you say, it's not surprising that there are those disconnects given what we've just been through for the last 18 months, but the speed at which we can repair that and give people hope and give people vision and new ideas and being bold. I mean, leaders need to be bold. So that I think the sooner we can do, as leaders, we get back into that, and the better.
I guess I'll give my last thought, then I'll turn it to you for a last thought, is that one of the boldest leaders of all time in business was Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs never used focus groups.
No, that's right.
He had the boldness of vision and then trusted his team, often with all kinds of strange methods, which might not be particularly appropriate these days, to make it happen. What was it Henry Ford said is, in designing the Model T Ford, if I gave the customers what they wanted, I would have built a faster horse.
That's right.
We need political leaders who stop building faster horses.
Yeah. No, and that's right. It is about, and in my old business, in the luxury hotel business, and you all understand this, you do the research, but actually the premium pricing is on the things people didn't know they could have.
Yeah.
So, and in my Glen Eagles days, we could have researched falconry and off-road driving and all those things until the cows come. What would you like? And those things would never have come up on anybody's list.
No.
But as soon as we did them, hugely popular, very profitable, and it's a high, a premium price product because it was special, unique, different, and people were very happy to pay for it.
And if I was to go back to the early days and you were looking at a vision which is more a direction of travel, words like unique luxury experience might have strung together.
Yeah.
And with that vision, you could go, what might sit under that? And somebody goes, we have a thing called falconry. I think our guests might like that.
Yeah. That's right. And if you look back now I looked at some numbers from Glen Eagles recently, and one of the really popular things that's really growing very quickly is ferreting. Who knew? So it's the same with my silver business, showing people how the silver, that beautiful piece of jewelry or whatever is made, adds enormous value.
Mm.
Just buying a piece of silver off the shelf, well, it's fine, but you don't think about how it was made. And often you probably think it was probably made by a machine anyway. But when you go up to workshops and see human beings actually creating something, creating a beautiful piece out of great skill and knowledge, that's humbling. And it's, and you're prepared, you'd pay twice as much money for it because you see the work that's gone into it.
If we could talk for hours, I can't help myself but say one or two more things. I think of the hotel business and I think what we're talking about is experiences.
Yeah.
And when we can travel, because there may be times when the world gets locked down again, but we will value those in-person experiences so much more. And, the idea 15, 20 years ago of having a make-it-yourself dinner for a corporate group of 50 visiting a hotel, somebody came up with that, but doesn't that cocktail taste much better if you made it yourself? Doesn't that dessert taste much better if somebody in your group made it for you?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of my own experiences. And things like, when businesses start saving on office space, a whole bunch of them are already looking at, let's get together and have real experiences at hotels outside cities. It's adaptability. In the face of all of this and having vision and then just connecting the players together and going, how do we make this work and what do people want and giving them something to look forward to? I shall shut up now. If you just pause, and what are your sort of final thoughts you might give to an audience?
Final thought is, incredibly exciting time. I mean, these are very difficult, and as we've discussed, very difficult and worrying and disconnected times, and people are feeling very nervous and edgy, but equally there are opportunities are enormous, and the leadership piece here, I mean, it's so important now that leaders really think about what they're doing and how they're going to articulate and protect that vision and how they're going to inject hope and fun on the journey so that people really get excited about the next journey. And it is a journey. And this is, it's the next 5 to 10 years, I think, are going to be very exciting. Difficult, of course. But we've also got young people coming through who are kind of used to more disconnected and short term and getting things done quickly in their own way, in their own time. So that change is coming through as well, which is exciting.
I just saw in you talking about all of that challenge in the next 5, 10 years, I just pictured you, 35 years ago, taking on Gleneagles and just seeing that challenge ahead of you.
Oh, yeah.
So it just takes the right kind of leader to grasp this nettle. Thank you so much, Peter. We've gone way over time, and it's absolutely wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Really appreciate it.
Bye. Thank you.